Support for the Capital Connection comes from Clean Path New York, working to support New York's economy and bring New Yorkers renewable energy while helping to create jobs. CleanPathNY.com for information.
United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
And New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. With us this week is Blair Horner, the executive director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, or NYPIRG. He's probably the most educated and interesting person about state government that I know. He's back again. Welcome, Blair.
Thanks for having me, Alan.
Okay, let's talk about the end of the session. Give us the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Well, you know, like in any session, there is good, bad, and ugly all the time. The session, it was interesting. It was really, you know, the first sort of real session since the pandemic hit. And for the first time in a while, legislators were around the Capitol in person. Lobbyists were, you know, pestering them in the hallways. And so in some ways, it was like the pre-pandemic days. On the other hand, you know, committee meetings were still done remotely, and virtually on via Zoom. They weren't in person. And the Capitol, despite the fact that there were lobbyists prowling around, it was not nearly as, you know, packed cheek to jowl like you normally have with protesters. So it was definitely off in that way. But it was the first session where you started to feel like things were, you know, heading to whatever the new normal is going to look like. The other thing that's sort of different, though, about the session is since the Democrats have taken over and you have sort of unity in government in terms of the governor being a Democrat, and both houses being run by Democrats, particularly with supermajorities, the amount of bills that passed, the trajectory on that really changed starting in 2019, where in the years prior to that, the number of bills that passed had been increasingly diminishing, in other words, decreasing over time. There's been a big uptick, and last year, the session that just wrapped up a couple of weeks ago, is the first really where you saw this sort of dramatic increase far beyond what has happened in a long time. And so, in a sense, those were interesting trends. The good news was, you know, things were starting to get sort of back to normal. And the state had a lot of money to spend, and they did it. I suppose that's good news. The bad news is, you know, in many ways, the public side of how the government operated was still way too secret, much more so than it had been even pre-pandemic. And the ugly part is, you know, things were happening at the last minute, were getting jammed through in the budget. So at the end of the budget process, for example, there was $1 billion subsidy for the Buffalo Bills Stadium, which really there hadn't been a lot of public discussion of that in advance. And at the end of session, there was a $10 billion pool of money put together for chipped fab investments by the state, which is supposed to match whatever the feds do. And that was particularly ugly because there had been no discussion on that really in any public way anyway, going into the end of session. So that's sort of a short, maybe meandering answer to your simple question.
Well, no, you can never meander, my friend Blair, but what you could do is give us a few more specifics in terms of outcome.
Well, I mean, just to go back to the numbers for a second, it was the most bills that passed in a session since Hugh Carey was governor. So that's a big difference, you know, and the Hugh Carey, and, you know, on average, you know, there was like 1,000 bills that would pass per year. And in this past one, was over 1,000 bills passed, which was, you know, sort of, again, a numerical change that is different. Under Andrew Cuomo, the average was about 670 bills passing. So it was a big increase. But in terms of the sort of more specific stuff in the budget, one of the things that we liked was the investments in higher education. They could have done more, but they did do plenty, and it was probably the best higher education budget in at least a decade. The bad news was, again, I think the process itself was highly secretive, as secretive as I've ever seen, if not the most secretive budget process and end of session process, partly due to the pandemic and partly due to the way that they wanted to operate.
Yeah, in fact, Blair Horner, this issue of transparency is very interesting. Governor Hochul has said she wants to have an open, transparent administration. Yet she also told me that the nature of budget negotiations requires that they be done behind closed doors. Sounds like the same old. Your thoughts?
Yeah, it does sound that way. I think every governor, I haven't been around watching this place as long as you, Alan, of course. But
that's
my
true,
first
because
governor,
nobody's older than I am.
Yeah. You and Dirt, right? You're racing to see who's the oldest. The session that I was, you know, the governor that I most closely followed was Mario Cuomo, although I was involved with NYPERG when Hugh Carey was governor. But over the time since Mario Cuomo, every governor, when they first come into office, says they're going to be open and transparent. And then it ain't so. And part of it is the way that sort of the institutions are set up under the state constitution. It lends itself into backroom dealing. But that's not an excuse. That it's harder to get it done in public. I think what happens is people become creatures of the Capitol, and they think about what's easiest for them, and they don't think about the fact that they're public servants and they're supposed to be doing their work in the open so that the public, whose money it is, by the way, know what the heck's going on.
Blair Horner, let me ask you this. It just doesn't seem to me, you know, I've been around a long time, it doesn't seem like it's the same that it used to be. I used to have a guy named Vinny in my class, and he used to ask that kind of question, like, is it the same?
Well, the Hochul administration is different from the Cuomo administration. There's much less ranting and raving at people and a more, you know, professional will agree to disagree type thing. And, you know, not to say that it isn't elbows out, you know, under the basket, but it, you know, it's not the same. It's more, the Hochul administration seems to be behaving in a way that you would expect of a gubernatorial administration, and what historically had been the case, even when other governors would get mad at us and yell at us and that kind of stuff, which always happens, people get mad. It wasn't the sort of unrelenting abuse that was heaped on anyone who dared to differ.
With Cuomo,
and Hochul's,
yeah,
with Andrew Cuomo, and so the Hochul administration is very different in that regard. And the fact that she's not elected, at least not yet, to be governor, I think impacts her relationship with the legislature in the sense that the legislature feels like that they have more say over things. And that's probably I think they do. Whereas under Andrew Cuomo was much more of an imperial governor who was at the height of his skills. He's extremely skilled politician and governor, and he was able to get what he wanted most of the time. And the legislature was really relegated to being the junior partner. This is a much more equal relationship between the executive and the legislature. I mean, that being said, this current governor does have vast executive powers, and she does push it to her advantage, as seen by the Buffalo Billion deal and the $10 billion chip fab deal at the end of session.
She's been very nice to public radio and to me in particular, and we have asked, and she's come. It really does seem like there's less potential for manipulation on her part than in past governors like Cuomo.
Yeah, intimidation is the word that I would use. That when you rule through fear, and that is the way that you sort of command the stage, is through fear. Anyone who acts like they're not afraid of you then has to be, you know, beaten into submission. That is not the way that the current governor, or at least so far anyway, seems to operate, that she's much more aware or tolerant of the fact that, you know, we live in a democracy and you're going to have a cacophony of different sort of voices. And the idea is to try to, push, herd the cats toward a goal to get things done. And it's more, again, I think of a more traditional, more democratic small D approach to the governor's mansion. I mean, all these governors, the longer they're in office, the more imperial they become. But I thought in the case of Governor Hochul's predecessor, that it was pretty much from the get-go that they were going to rule through fear. And that was sort of that great quote from the top aide to the governor when they were in a phone conversation with the Connecticut governor's office. This is back in 2011. that it, you know, they have two speeds, get along or kill. I think that is exactly exactly the way they viewed it, and I don't think that the Hochul team would ever say anything like that.
Talk to me a little bit, Blair Horner, if you would, about the Buffalo mass shooting and how that has had a ripple effect through the entire state political apparatus.
Well, I think I'm going to take a little bit broader view of that. I mean, this governor was dealt, I thought, a pretty good hand to start her, you know, her relationship with the legislature in particular. She got tons of money from the feds, and then, you know, having more money makes it easier to get a budget than being broke. Not to say that it's easy, but it's easier.
Sure.
And I thought that the, you know, as some of the low hanging fruit got used up by Governor Hochul's, some of the more festering problems that are hard to deal with emerged. And then you add to that things like what was happening with inflation in particular, and then the sort of the blowback against the crime package that had passed the year before. You know, it's, Democrats were back on their heels. And I think the issues around the mass shootings in New York and Texas, and as well as the leaked document by Alito for the Supreme Court on, with regard to Roe, I think allows Democrats to sort of talk about things that the public is keenly interested in, but where they have a lot of support. And when it comes to things like gun control or even abortion rights, New Yorkers tend to be more in sync with the Democrats on that. And so I think that the impact of the mass shootings, like, beyond horrible, for sure, and far too frequent in America. I mean, it's sort of it's a public health crisis in the United States. I think allows Governor Hochul to sort of drive the agenda back onto firmer footing for her. And that led to, legislation passing at the end of session dealing with gun issues and some issues dealing with reproductive rights. And there, she's making noise about bringing them back for special session, depending on what the Supreme Court does with regard to New York State's gun control laws and abortion rights. And again, I think that if she does that, let's say in September, I think that those things not only are probably important policies to Democratic voters, but allow Democrats to project an image to voters generally in New York, where voters are going to be very sympathetic to them in a climate which could be very negative for Democrats, given what's happening with inflation and crime and the ongoing pandemic.
So let me ask you this, Blair Horner. Federal-state competition relationships. I personally cannot remember a time when I felt that the state had been so subsumed in terms of what they were doing, policy that they were passing, compared to what was going on in Washington. Do you have any impression on that?
So let me just see if I understand your point. So your point is that that we're sort of much more in sync with Washington or completely out of sync?
No. Washington is where the action is, not New York state government.
I see. Yeah. I mean, I agree with that. And I think part of it is what's been happening sort of in the United States over time is, you know, that increasingly issues get nationalized. And so the way you resolve them is in Washington. And that's a political strategy on both political parties and to some extent a reflection of the growing, you know, access to information about what goes on in Washington. However, I think New York still does play an important role in driving some issue areas where Washington's in gridlock. The most obvious is climate change, where there's one new senator from West Virginia who stops the trains in D.C. in terms of dealing with the obvious, most terrible, horrible thing that facing the world, which is the global warming due to the burning of fossil fuels and other human activity. And yet the Congress can't act. So states like New York, Massachusetts, California, even Vermont, they can lead the charge and drive national policy. And one of the examples is auto emission standards, where California sets the standard for auto emission, miles per gallon and auto emissions in a way that the Congress never would be able to act. So I agree that I think the world is evolving in a way that leads to people looking at Washington because the issues are so gigantic, it's hard to imagine how a state could deal with it. But states like New York can play a role in driving the national agenda if you have inspired, creative, and educated leadership.
Blair Horner, gun control, two words which have been pretty well impressed on our politics and our minds. And, you know, New York is no different than any other place. We know that there's some real problems, including the idea that somehow you would say, okay, we'll try to control it in New York, but we know New York is in many ways interdependent with other states. So what do you make of all that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, this is not an issue where I would claim any particular expertise in terms of what's the right solution to the problems. But the politics of it are terrible in terms of, you know, protecting people. And, you know, the United States, Americans are armed to the teeth with guns in a way that you don't see anywhere else, certainly in the Western world. And as a result, not surprisingly, we have, you know, an unbelievable amount of murder, homicides, suicides. That you don't see in other countries, advanced countries anyway. And so, you know, what the solution is, of, you know, there's a lot of experts out there that have solutions to that, but the politics are bad because the NRA and their, you know, allies are able to stop national progress. In New York, the laws are much stronger than you find in much of the rest of the country, but those are all at risk depending on what the Supreme Court decides to do later this month.
So, despite Governor Hochul's newly passed gun control legislation, you don't see much changing.
Well, you know, it's hard to deal with a problem that is national in scope in one state all by itself, particularly if the Supreme Court says that you don't have the rights to do it as a state. And again, we'll see what the Supreme Court decides. They may decide differently and keep New York's gun control laws in effect. But, you know, I mean, New York City is a densely populated, you know, city with lots of people in it, where they have to climb onto mass transit systems to get around. It's not like you just walk anywhere. I mean, yes, you could walk places, but you'd have to long walk. You can't get around in a car very easily. And yet, you know, it's one of the safest cities in America. And to some extent, you have to say that it's because of the restrictions on getting access to weapons that can cause a lot of harm quickly. And that doesn't mean it's immune to it, because, again, New York is not an island unto itself. But the crime problem in New York City, even though it's increasing, is far lower than it's been in the past and far lower than many other cities in New York and the country.
Well, that may be the case. Nevertheless, I don't know that that's the perception on the part of the electorate.
Well, I mean, it's gotten worse. And so that's what the public is perceiving. Now, again, I think some of this is due to the pandemic. People have been cooped up for a long time. It has to have an effect on the mental health of many people. And the pandemic hasn't ended. And, you know, you add that to the corrosive political environment that we're in, where, you know, you have a former president of the United States essentially egging on riots. You know, the country is in a place where it's, you know, the emotions are rubbed raw and people have problems or grievances, view violence as a responsible solution to those. And so, you know, it's worse in New York than it was a few years ago. And so I think that's what people perceive. Their lives are getting worse, and that's how they react to it. And then at great peril to incumbent legislators.
So does that change our current political situation? In other words, we have Democrats and Republicans. Republicans have won. Governor Pataki had three terms. What is the state of politics in New York State?
I don't like to get too far out on these branches, but, you know, I think if you look at Nassau County, where Democrats have an enrollment advantage, where they had a woman who had been the Democratic woman who had been the county executive, and you look at what happened in 2021, the election, the Democrats got crushed in Nassau County. And the suburbs are where the battlegrounds play out in New York State. The urban areas Democratic, the rural areas Republican, and really the swing of the suburban vote. And right now, Democrats are taking on water when it comes to suburban voters. Now, that being said, running statewide in New York for Republicans is no easy task. I mean, you mentioned Pataki, but the last time he got elected was 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And that was the last time any Republican got elected statewide. And I think swimming in Republican politics with the giant cinder block known as Donald Trump around your neck, it doesn't make it any easier in a place like New York, where Trump is so unpopular. That being said, Republicans have to feel like the wind is to their back. And if they come up with the right candidate, I think they could give Hochul a real run for the money.
Do they have the right candidate? Is there any potential for having the right candidate? Well, I keep racking my brain. I don't see it.
Well, I mean, for a Republican to win, they have to have their party backing them solidly. And they have to appeal to everybody who's not a Democrat. Right. I mean, that math adds up. That's what Pataki did. And even if you can bite away some of the Democrats, I suppose, right? So who's the candidate that can knit together independent-leaning voters and Republican voters? It's a tough challenge because the base of the Republican Party is so tied to Trump and his lies about the election that it makes it hard to appeal to independents at the same time. But they have candidates that can do that. And so we'll see if they nominate them.
Why don't you name one who you think that they ought to nominate in order to win?
Well, I'm not going to tell the Republicans what to do, but there are candidates. Well, because I'm not a partisan guy, right? I
mean, you don't have to be partisan. You have to be an objective realist who looks at the way in which this is all developing. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm racking my brain for who they got.
I mean, you know, they have the four major candidates are, you know, a member of Congress, Zeldin, the son of the former mayor, Andrew Giuliani. They have the candidate who ran and won, but then lost as a county executive in Westchester County, which is heavily Democratic, Rob Astorino. And they have a billionaire Republican who almost knocked out Tom DiNapoli when he ran for comptroller, who had worked in the Obama administration to help deal with the auto crisis, a guy named Harry Wilson. So how those candidates are able to sort of both win over the Republican primary voters and then have enough appeal to reach out to independents, I think, you know, time will tell. We'll see if they can craft messages to do that.
I'm a huge comptroller fan in New York State. How come he has never been named as a potential gubernatorial candidate for the Democrats?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think he has to sort of make the, you know, the way you set up a race is you have to go set it up. You can't just have it, you know, come to you. It's rare that that happens. I mean, I guess you could argue Elliot Spitzer might have been one of them. Maybe Andrew Cuomo was another in terms of where the party was like, well, you're the guy. But in the case of the Democrats, I mean, you know, DiNapoli really hasn't made the moves that you would normally associate with trying to set up. And he had been handed the position. Remember, he was originally became comptroller because his predecessor, Alan Hevesy, resigned. And he was appointed essentially by the legislature, essentially sure. Sheldon Silver, to be the comptroller. And so he got it handed to him. And so he hasn't shown any interest in it. And you got to play in order to win.
There's a coming Supreme Court decision on concealed carry, which the governor and others have expressed real concerns about. And you?
Well, again, it's not an area where I have tremendous expertise, but the idea of people wandering around in the city with concealed weapons, that does concern me. I would be unnerved by that prospect. And not necessarily because an individual might do something, although that's possible, but that somebody who wants to do something could just grab the gun out of their pocket and do it. To me, personally, not organizationally, it seems to be a senseless way to go about public policy is to have people wandering around with concealed weapons.
I know that for years you've been very concerned, Blair Horner, with ethics reform. Are we going to ever get this right?
Hope springs eternal, Alan. Hope springs eternal.
What really is at the top of your ethics reform list?
Well, you know, every year it's a little bit different depending on what's going on. So we had pushed for the elimination of J. Cope and its replacement by an independent entity, and that didn't happen. So the new entity will take over in early July, I believe. And so, you know, we'll have to see how that plays out. And the state's system of public financing sort of kicks off after this election cycle. And so there may be in the area of campaign finance, you know, interesting things that emerge out of that or the successes or failures out of the new ethics agency that emerges out of that. But I think that one of the things that, you know, when you look at Governor Hochul's fundraising, she's done a lot of it through people that have lobbyist connections or business before the government. And I think the issue of how do you restrict people's abilities to influence public policy or contracting decisions by their campaign contributions is an issue that I think could deserve some exploration once the dust settles from this November. And, you know, clearly from our perspective, you know, the effort to keep making New York a leader on voting rights is going to be an issue that's front and center. We'll have to see how things play out. One of the interesting bills that passed in the budget this year was a requirement that every college campus that has 300 registered voters or more living on campus have to have a polling site. That starts this November. And that could make a big difference in terms of developing the muscle memory for 18 to 21-year-olds who are in college to learn how the democratic process, small D, plays out and how voting is done and how you register and everything else. Maybe make a big difference, maybe a sleeper issue in terms of how the elections play out, particularly in upstate.
Let's talk a little bit about the very complex redistricting question. Now we have people like Carolyn Maloney and Jerry Nadler potentially running against each other. So how chaotic is the redistricting process going to prove to New York politics?
Well, it's like, you know, I think it's unprecedented chaos. And it's because, you know, the courts drew the lines, right? So some guy down in Pennsylvania, who's an expert, is going to draw the lines for the state. He has no interest. He doesn't look at anybody's address. He doesn't care who wins or who loses. He's like, well, these are the maps that make the most sense. So it's sort of the most impartial person you might be able to find out. I don't know anything about the guy, so I'm just assuming he's impartial. Who knows, right? But that's as far as I can tell, I think a reasonable guess. And when you do that and you don't look at people's addresses or anything, districts that were sort of twisted around and didn't make any sense in the past now look different. And just visually looking at the maps now, they're cleaner to look at than they were. But you end up with guys like Maloney and Nadler, longtime Democratic lions in the Congress, in the same district.
So how does that get resolved?
That's the way it's going to play out. It's going to be politics.
Yeah, who wins, you know, Nadler or Maloney?
I think it's actually, this may sound like a cop-out, but I think it's too early to tell.
Yeah.
Because the petitioning process still has to kick in. You're going to have to raise the campaign contribution. Who has the on-the-ground game? Who is the sharpest in terms of running for office? I mean, Maloney's had a series of serious challengers in terms of primaries.
Absolutely.
Who hasn't, right? And so I don't know. Does that help her and hurt him? Does that help him and hurt her? I don't know.
And has he always been sort of Mr. Liberal when it comes to New York politics? So that's a question we'll have to answer, Blair Horner, in a future show. That's because we're almost out of time right now. So I'll give you 30 seconds to say anything you want to say.
Well, that was a great segue to wrapping it up, Alan, as usual. Good job.
And good job to you, my friend. It's always fun to talk to Blair Horner, the executive director of NYPIRG. Again, Blair, thanks so much for being here and for all you do to keep this state honest. It's a great thing we see.
Thanks, Alan.